Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou. Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He's the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, Paul.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show, John.
Paul, I want to talk about an article that appeared today in the Wall Street Journal. And it appeared today because it's relevant to the George Floyd case, but it has a very long and very ugly history, including in my own little hometown of Newcastle, Pennsylvania, in Lawrence County. I want to get to that in a minute. But this is this doctrine, this legal doctrine of felony murder. So felony murder is when there are multiple people committing a crime, one of the people kills someone, and that means everybody gets charged with murder. So maybe you're the getaway car driver, maybe you're the lookout, but if somebody gets killed, you all face the death penalty. Tell us about felony murder and about the history of this idea.
Well, I'm actually pretty familiar with the felony murder doctrine because I was convicted under it in 1987 in Washington State. And it's actually a little bit more far-reaching than just towards the accomplices. One of the reasons that it's kind of bad, I think, for the people who get charged with it is the fact that basically prosecutors are able to convict people under felony murder even if there was no intent to kill anyone. And all they have to show is that there was another crime or an underlying crime that was being committed, whether it's burglary or robbery, fleeing from the police is another common one, or anything like that, where someone winds up getting killed. In other words, crimes that would normally be manslaughter or negligent homicide then get bumped up to first-degree murder based on this doctrine. And the doctrine's been around for over 100 years. And the theory behind it is that everyone involved in committing a crime where someone dies can get charged with first-degree murder, and they do. And I was really surprised to read this Wall Street Journal article saying that it's a controversial legal doctrine because it's been on the books for well over 100 years. Thousands of people have been convicted under this felony murder law every year annually in the 37 or 38 states that have it on the books. And I haven't really heard anyone say it's controversial. I think there's a lot of criminal defendants and criminal defense attorneys who think it, and criminal justice advocates who think it's problematic, but I haven't heard any prosecutors or judges voice any big concerns.
Well, yeah, it's only controversial in this case because it's cops being charged.
Right. And I think that might be the, you know, but I think for the people that find that controversial, the controversy is the police are being charged with murdering people, not the doctrine that they're being charged with. But I think that it's one of those things where, in some respects, the most obvious injustice of it was a case that Alan Dershowitz, who's in the news because of the Jeffrey Epstein stuff, he challenged a case in the 1980s, a case called Tyson versus Arizona, where some kids busted their father out of prison and he went on to kill someone unbeknownst to them. And then they were all charged with murder and got the death penalty. And the U.S. Supreme Court said that that was perfectly okay. So, you know, so around the country, we see, you know, like I say, these laws have been on the books for decades. People have been getting charged with them for literally over a century. And, you know, and prosecutors have been perfectly fine with it. And I think that a lot of the injustices of this are, you know, when I was in prison, there's one guy that I knew. He and a friend had been robbing a bank. The police showed up and killed his friend. He didn't shoot anyone, injure anyone. And then he got charged with murder because the police killed his accomplice. And he was dutifully convicted of that murder the police carried out. So there's a lot of outcomes that unfortunately the courts have all upheld and said this is all fine, where it seems pretty unjust, where it's situations where lots of people are going to prison for murders they didn't commit because someone else committed them. In plenty of other cases, people are getting convicted of first-degree murder even when they lacked any intent to kill or hurt anyone. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out in these cases being used against these police officers that murder people. But, you know, a lot of the my observation is over the years about how a lot of these police killings are prosecuted is, first off, there's the rarity that these cases are even prosecuted at all. As we know, you know, the vast majority of police killings of citizens never result in a prosecution of any type. That's number one. And then number two is the kind of the lackluster the lackluster way in which these cases are prosecuted. In other words, the prosecutors have plenty of tools at their disposal, and they rarely use even a fraction of the tools they use against the poor people and the people of color that normally fill the dockets of our criminal courts and fill our prison. So that's kind of, you know, it's interesting to see that they're using even somewhat half-hearted legal measures to prosecute these cops. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Pennsylvania is considering changes to this felony murder law right now. And it's because there are no good news stories that come out of this policy. This woman from my hometown, Marcia Skaggs, this is a particularly terrible story. She was with a friend, an accomplice, and they were robbing a drug dealer in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. They suspected this drug dealer might be a police informant, and the accomplice ordered Marcia Skaggs to shoot him. She refused to shoot him, so he shot the guy, and Marcia Skaggs was found guilty of felony murder and is serving life without parole. She's now 56 years old. She's been in prison for 30 years, and because this doctrine is law, as you said, settled in the case of Tyson versus Arizona back in the 80s, she's got no chance to ever get out. Well, there's a similar story also in Pennsylvania, and this is a woman who was 18 years old at the time of her crime and a 16-year-old accomplice. They were robbing a gas station. She served as the lookout. The 16-year-old shot a clerk and killed him. His sentence was later vacated because he was a minor. He ended up being paroled. And even though he was the shooter, she's the one that got life without parole. That's one way in which this felony murder doctrine is just so patently unfair. Okay, so that's Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, at least there are rumblings of trying to reform this thing. Is there any chance of reform anywhere else in America?
Well, California recently changed their felony murder law, and yeah, I think it's so far still a little too soon to tell how that's actually playing out. But California is one of the few states that's actually considered any changes, positive criminal changes to their criminal code in a long time. Usually, it's interesting because, you know, when we talk about mass incarceration, you know, I kind of roll my eyes when I hear about, you know, all this talk about criminal justice reform. And that when you actually get down to it, nothing's really changing. And the critical thing is that, you know, the United States, it took us between 1776 and 1990, it took us 214 years to lock up our first million people. And then between 1990 and 2000, we doubled our prison population to 2 million. So 214 years to lock up a million people, 10 years to lock up the next million. And here we are 20 years after that, or 30 years from 1990, and our prison and jail population is around 2.5 million people or so. And, you know, the big thing is, you know, like what happened in the 90s? Why did our prison population double? And it wasn't that we had an outbreak of crime or Americans are more criminal or were doing a lot more things. The big thing is the sentences were changed. You know, more conduct was criminalized. And the big thing was sentences were changed a lot. And where a lot of this stuff came out was sentences. State legislatures and the U.S. Congress went through the statute books and they lengthened the sentences for literally thousands of criminal offenses. And murder was one of the offenses. For example, in California, for well over 100 years, the penalty for murder was 7 to life. In other words, people could be released from prison within 7 years. Very few were, but it was an option. And so then they changed that. So now it's 25 to life, 25 years before a person can be even considered for release. And then they stack a parole board with law enforcement hacks and failed politicians that ensure that very few people are actually released. And this phenomenon kind of played itself out around the country. Sentences that, you know, life without, and it's important to note that life without parole is a relatively modern concept, not just in the United States, but also worldwide. And globally, very few countries have sentences as long as the United States does. I think most people that are in tune with criminal justice issues know that the United States is an outlier when it comes to the death penalty. I think the United States and Japan are the only two industrialized countries that routinely execute their citizens. Most other countries don't, but where the United States is really out of whack with the rest of the world, and this is like the entire world, not just industrialized democracies like Western Europe, but it's the length of our sentences. And life without parole is, I think, the biggest one. You know, we call that the other death penalty or death by incarceration. But when you compare the United States that has literally hundreds of thousands of prisoners serving sentences of life without parole, or who may as well be serving sentences of life without parole, and you compare that with other countries that have, you know, maximum sentences that prisoners can serve. China is a country, they have a 20-year maximum sentence. Brazil has a 30-year maximum sentence. France has a 20-year maximum sentence. Lots of countries around the world cap the amount of time that prisoners can serve, regardless of the crimes that they're convicted of.
In the European Union, life is 20 years. And over the course of the 20 years, based on your behavior, of course, in prison, you're moved from the highest security prison down to the lowest security prison. And over the course of that 20-year sentence, you're taught a skill. So when you go out, you can be an electrician or a plumber or a mechanic or a beekeeper, which is a big thing in Greek prisons. But even if you're an arch terrorist, like the leaders of Revolutionary Organization 17 November, the notorious Greek terrorist group, who were sentenced to 1,645 years in prison each. 1,645 years is 20 years. And so at the end of 20 years, you get out. That's just standard operating procedure. The sentences that we have here in the United States are draconian by anybody's measure.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when you talk about that in Russia, I believe the maximum sentence in Russia is 15 years, and that's a holdover from Stalin's day. So, you know, we see around the world, but, you know, we don't even need to go that far away. Canada, I think, you know, our neighbor to the north, you know, their criminal justice system, I think with very good reason, doesn't get a lot of headline news because certainly compared to the American prison system and criminal justice system, it's relatively well run. Yes, they have abuses. Yes, they have problems, but they tend to be few and far between. And, you know, as far as their sentences go, and I say this because I have a lot of friends that are activists and criminal justice reformers in Canada. And all I can say is that, you know, their existence as criminal justice reformers is a lot different than mine is here in the United States. And one of the things is with Canada, what's happened is they have a relatively small prison population per capita compared to the number of people they have in their country that are locked up. But the other thing is, you know, when you look at the sentences aren't that long. I mean, you have people, you have kind of two pools. When Canada abolished the death penalty, they required a 25-year mandatory prison term for people convicted of first-degree murder that otherwise would not be executed because they did away with the death penalty. But then they have a sentence review after 15 years. So it's possible for people to get out after 15 years, depending on, you know, whether or not they present a danger to society. But it's interesting is where these discussions have gone in the United States. Here in the U.S., sentences were pretty arbitrarily just extended for a whole slew of crimes across the board. And the fact that, you know, many people convicted of murder are serving a sense of life without parole just based on, you know, just based on the conviction, not necessarily, you know, the severity of the crime, not based on, you know, on anything else. And these were crimes that for most of American history had sentences of, you know, 10, 15, even 20 years. And 20 years for a long time was considered a life sentence in this country. And then these numbers were just arbitrarily extended. And I think that's part of the problem that we've had in this country is that we have politicians vying to see who can be tough on crime or who can be tougher than the other guy, except for when it comes to crimes committed by law enforcement, in which case no one wants to be tough on anyone. But generally for all these other crimes, it's literally the sky's the limit. If one politician said, you know, the minimum sentence for murder should be 20 years, someone else said, well, why not 40? And then, well, heck, let's just make it life without parole. That's exactly what they did. And that's part of the thing that's led to both this massive prison population that we have in the United States, including the people, like you note, in Pennsylvania that are serving sentences of life without parole. But also it's kind of turned so many American prisons into de facto, on the one hand, nursing homes and geriatric hospitals, and then death camps with all these people that are slated and destined to die behind bars.
I want to ask you about the George Floyd situation, too, because this is kind of putting the shoe on the other foot. You've got a second degree murder charge against Officer Chauvin, right? This was filed on June 3rd. But the reason why it's considered felony murder is because it was a murder committed while attempting to commit a felony offense, namely third degree assault. Okay. And there are aiding and abetting charges against the other three officers. So this is kind of an odd situation. You've got a situation where Officer Chauvin is now facing 40 years in prison for what really was an accidental death. And at first he was supposed to be charged, or he was initially charged with, what was it, third degree manslaughter or some minor thing like that? Give me your thoughts on how this is going to play out in Minnesota. And what about the other three officers? What do you think will happen with them?
Well, it's hard to predict. I mean, basically, I mean, we see so many cases where officers are literally on video committing vile crimes. And I think, you know, for those of us old enough to remember the Rodney King beatings. I mean, you know, tens of millions of people saw the police brutally beat Rodney King on video, and yet they were acquitted in state court. Here in Florida, for example, Frank Valdez was a death row prison. He'd been convicted of killing a prison guard in an escape attempt, and prison guards literally beat him to death. Every single one of his ribs was broken. He had boot marks on his face. When they did the autopsy, his testicles were crushed, and they tried the prison guards in state court, and they were all acquitted. So I think it's far from a foregone conclusion that anyone's going to get convicted criminally in George Floyd's murder. And just because, you know, the track record of police being convicted of crimes or murder in these police killings is very low. And as I mentioned earlier, I think that one of the reasons for this is the lackluster prosecutions that take place. And, you know, and frankly, I think there's elements of jury nullification that happen where lawyers essentially argue to a jury, look, the police are keeping dangerous, scary black people at bay, and we're going to kill some, but that's the price society has to pay to keep you members of the jury safe. And unfortunately, that, based on the track record of the last couple of decades, that carries the day a lot. The fact that the prosecution has charged, I think, the police in George Floyd's murder case with felony murder, I think, is a substantial departure from the normal, half-hearted and lackluster prosecutions that we historically see in these cases. So, you know, whether or not that carries through to trial, I think remains to be seen. But again, I think in some respects, you know, what we've been seeing for the past 40 or 50 years, though, with regards to these police killings and beatings, is it's kind of like getting hit by lightning from the police officer's perspective. Is you can kill a lot of people and get away with it. And then I don't think that anyone thinks that but for the media attention and the outrage by the citizens, I don't think anyone thinks that the officers in this case would have been charged with a crime. It would have just been business as usual.
I think you're probably right. I want to move on to some other issues. And at the risk of sounding a little bit like a broken record week to week, I want to talk about COVID-19 spreading yet more in the U.S. prison system. Let's talk first about Florida. In Prison Legal News, you've been covering this issue very closely, Paul. The governor of Florida has refused to release prisoners during this COVID-19 outbreak. Other governors are releasing prisoners, maybe not a lot, but some are being released, especially those who have pre-existing conditions and whose health might be fragile. But in Florida, this refusal to release anybody is resulting really in what amounts to a death sentence.
Yes, and I think that just goes to show that for so many people in the political classes in America, including obviously Governor DeSantis and many others, in political office, they view prisoners as an expendable population. They really don't care if prisoners live or die. Ironically, I find it, you know, kind of bitterly ironic if, you know, what could amount to the, you know, a large reduction in our prison population isn't going to be because people were released or because of sentencing reform, but because politicians and prison officials just let them die. And sadly, you know, it seems like that may be where, you know, where we may be headed. So, but yeah, Governor DeSantis, he's pretty much refused to release few, if any, prisoners in Florida. But, you know, and this is far from an outlier. I mean, we've seen Governor Cuomo in New York has also taken the same step. to the extent we've seen some prisoners released, it's been in California as part of a court order and their overcrowding case. But all they did there was basically they sped up the release of prisoners that are within 60 days of being released. We're not seeing prisoners necessarily being we're not seeing convicted prisoners being released from state prisons based on their vulnerabilities or their health situation or whatever. You know, they're still largely remaining locked up. And politicians have been pretty clear that they don't plan, you know, they're not planning to change that, or they're not planning to do anything differently, that they're planning to, keep that, keep that in place.
Tell us a little bit too, Paul, about the rates of coronavirus infection and deaths in prisons. I've been trying to follow this issue as closely as possible. It doesn't appear all in one place, and not surprisingly, it does not appear on the Bureau of Prisons website. We hear bits and pieces of information that the situation in prisons like those in Mississippi or Louisiana, those prisons in California, are just disaster areas. And many of these COVID infections are not being reported to federal authorities. What are you hearing about rates of infection and rates of death inside prisons?
Well, it's funny you should mention this, because literally just yesterday, some friends and colleagues at the University of California at Irvine, in collaboration with researchers at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, issued a report analyzing exactly that. What's the comparison between prison rates of COVID infection and non-prison rates of COVID infection? And I think that basically this is, you know, it's not going to be a surprise to anyone. But basically, it's much higher. It's around six times higher among prisoners than it is among the general population. At the time, they analyzed cases and deaths between March 31st and June 6th using public data from corrections departments' websites, news reports. And, you know, not surprisingly, the disparity is huge. So it comes down to, for every 100,000 prisoners, 3,251 of them were infected. And for non-prisoners, the rate was 587 per 100,000. And also, the other thing is that the death rate is three times higher in prison than it is outside of prison. So we've got 39 people dying of COVID for every 100,000 prisoners, and 29 people dying for every 100,000 people not in prison. And I think that, you know, it's important to note that if we want to treat America's prison and jail population as a city or town, we're talking 2.5 million people. So think of it as a city the size of Houston. The only thing is that the city is spread out across the country in little islands, you know, varying from, you know, tiny city jails or county jails that hold 10 prisoners to, you know, massive prisons in California that hold 6,000 or 7,000 prisoners in each one, or prison complexes or towns that hold 15,000 or 20,000 prisoners in different facilities within a few miles of each other. So I think that this is pretty grim news. But I also think that it's important to note, though, that, you know, we're kind of just getting started. You know, no one is saying that COVID has just, you know, is just a passing thing or that it's passed now. I mean, I think that we're going to see these numbers continue to increase, especially the death rate. And we're going to see those numbers continue to go up. And, you know, we're not really seeing much in the way of any type of, you know, public health response of any sort coming from the prisons. They're just kind of like taking an attitude of, well, let's just hope not too many people die, and we're not really going to do much to prevent it.
And tell us about this secret Bureau of Prisons document that was obtained by ProPublica. You've written about it in Prison Legal News, and it addresses this very issue.
Yes, and I think that the big thing that we've been kind of expecting is that prisons are going to be saying one thing publicly while doing another one kind of behind the scenes. And so basically, so this memo that was obtained by ProPublica, which is also on the Prison Legal News website, basically, it sets a security level for prisoners, everything based on what they've done in prison, any history of violence, things like that. And it's used to classify them as, you know, as either minimum, low, medium, or high risk. And so basically, this is supposedly what was being used to determine who was going to qualify as minimum security and then could potentially be sent to home confinement during the pandemic to, you know, reduce their risk. But it kind of, as we've seen, you know, even prisoners who did qualify under the secret memo as being low risk that should have been released were not. And then other prisoners have had their sentences dramatic, and, you know, especially a lot of high profile prisoners who were serving long sentences. For example, Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign manager, Michael Cohen, the president's former personal attorney. You know, these are some of the high profile prisoners that have been released supposedly because of COVID while serving fairly long sentences, whereas other prisoners at higher physical risk of contracting COVID, serving shorter sentences, who aren't politically connected and aren't wealthy, are being left to languish in federal prisons despite this.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He's the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area, and in Kansas City on 104.7 and 102.9 FM and 1140 AM. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.